Dame Lena Gaunt is a musician, an octogenarian, and a junkie. She's also the fictional protagonist at the heart of Tracy Farr's debut novel, The Life and Loves of Lena Gaunt. It's set in 1920 Sydney, and Dame Lena wants to be music's most modern musician. So she takes up one of the world's first electrical instruments, the theremin, and she enthralls the world with the eerie voice of this otherworldly instrument, which is played without touching it. But a career on the glittering world stage doesn't come without pain, and Lena Gaunt is reluctant to tell her story. Miyuki Yokiranta caught up with the author Tracy Farr from her sometimes hometown Perth, and it's where Lena Gaunt's story begins.
See, the book opens on a Perth beachscape, and floating in the ocean, an octogenarian is enjoying the sort of gentle roll of the waves. And this is Dame Lena Gaunt. And the swim is part of her preparation for her performance that evening. Can you tell us about that performance?
Yeah, Lena's been in retirement for very many years. When the novel opens, she's 80 years old, and she's been very much out of the public eye for 20 years. So she has been lured out of retirement to play at an electronic music festival that's being held in the hills just outside of Perth. And she's not quite sure whether she's been invited as an oddity or because of her really quite famous musical past, but she chooses to think it's the latter. And she walks onto the stage, and it's a little bit like greeting an old lover as she sees her theremin there on the stage in the spotlight. The way that scene pans out is that very little of it is described. It's almost as if the performance itself happens. It happens off stage, if you like, in the novel.
But it sets up an intrigue and a curiosity, and you've already used the word theremin. If we leave that as a kind of a morsel, a taster of what's to come, after this performance, she gets a letter from a filmmaker, Mo or Maureen Patterson, and Mo's curious to biograph Lena's life. She's retreated from public life, but Mo somehow manages to eke an agreement out of her. Why does Lena agree to be filmed?
Well, she's very reluctant at first, and she just says a flat out no. And so Maureen's job is to persuade her, to talk her round. And she does that in a way by establishing a relationship with Lena and the care that she will take. So she talks a lot. Mo talks a lot about the process of filmmaking and about the process of documenting a life. But most intriguingly for Lena, Mo talks about a short film that she made many years ago when she was a student or just coming out of her student days that was about someone very close to Lena in her past, in her own past. And it's that connection really is what tips Lena over and brings her round to agreeing to be part of it. But I think also underlying that is a feeling that Lena's kept a lot of things very secret. She's played them very close to her chest for very many years, and part of her agreeing to talk to Mo is her having a conversation with herself and saying, is it time? Am I ready to talk about things?
Which is the leaping off point for the retelling of Lena's story. And this is where we go into a bifurcated novel where there is a juxtaposition of present-day Perth and then this really fantastic joyride through a global universe of sounds and sights and smells. Yeah. And it begins in a wild and steamy childhood in Singapore, but a tragedy befalls the family. And Lena kind of left on her own to some extent, moves to 1920 Sydney, which is just the height of modernism at that time.
Yes.
And she meets the professor with a capital
she
P.
Does. Yes.
So who is the professor?
Well, the professor is my fictional take on the real-life inventor of what came to be known as the theremin. In late 1920s New York City, there was a Russian inventor by the name of Leon Theremin, lived and worked and invented, and one of the things he invented was what came to be known as the theremin. So I was really interested in transposing that action to 1920s Sydney, to jazz age Sydney, because that worked for my novel, but also to shift the focus away from the real life historical figures and events, because I wanted to make this story up. That was what I was interested in doing. So that was one of my reasons for not giving the professor a name. I just kept him as the capital P professor.
And really, he is the conduit for this instrument. So now we get to the crux of the novel, really, and it is the theremin. Can you describe what a theremin is, and more importantly, how it's played?
Yeah, the sort of theremin that Lena would have played would have looked like a piece of furniture, so quite a big wooden cabinet. They would have had knobs and dials and a loop, a metal loop to the left, and a metal antenna sticking up to the right. And to play the theremin, it was the first electronic musical instrument, essentially, or electrical musical instrument in those days. And it's played without touching. You don't bang on a theremin with a stick. You don't pluck at strings. You don't blow into it. You move your hands close to it, in proximity to it, but you never actually touch it. So to play the theremin, you move your left hand close to the loop to change the volume. And you move your right hand, and particularly your fingers, in what can be very precise movements, close to the aerial or antenna on the right that changes the pitch or the frequency. And at the time, or through the 30s, they were used as an instrument for playing classical music, and some people still use them in that sense today.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's an act of interference to some extent, because you're interfering with the electromagnetic fields. And so Lena, she's incredibly adept at this. And so what is it about this, her fingers, her touch, her way of negotiating space that is outstanding compared to anyone else that plays the instrument?
Music is the way that Lena observes the world and interprets the world, and it's almost the way she speaks with the world. It's almost on the level of the physics or the maths of the sound as well, that she just has an intuitive and very engaged connection with sound. And her engagement with the theremin is all about her love of the modern, and that's partly indicative of the age in which she's living. It's partly the reflection of the influence of her uncle, who shares that love of the modern and always has, and has instilled that in her to an extent.
And if we start looking into her life, really, in 1920s Sydney, that era of heady modernism, she's being shown at society parties with her instrument, it's this really quite elaborate and splendid display of prowess. And across the room from one of these parties, a beautiful and slightly strange and eerie woman catches her eye, and this turns out to be Beatrix Carmichael.
Yes.
And Beatrix is a painter, and the way that you describe Beatrix's painting in your novel brings to mind for me the work of Grace Cossington Smith, who was painting obviously in the same time, but also painted in kind of shards and angles, and certainly like Beatrix had an obsession with the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about Beatrix and her painting and her approach to her art.
Yes. Well, Beatrix, I'm glad you mentioned Grace Cossington Smith. She would be one of the women painters of the early 20th century who, I suppose, influenced my mental picture of the sort of art that Beatrix would have painted. Others of them would include Dorrit Black. I was also thinking of the New Zealand painter Rita Angus, particularly in the portraits that Beatrix moves on to paint later in the novel. Beatrix sees a similarity in the way that she bends light and makes it different. She sees the similarity between what she does with paint and light and what Lena does with sound and music with the theremin. She sees that they both take what they see and they make it strange, and then they make it beautiful again. On one level, that's how the women connect.
And the two of them start to create a life with one another. I agree with you. I really saw a parallel in the way that they approach their art. And for me, it was this idea of composition by looking at the whole and really looking at the space between elements. And another element that I saw as trope between the two of them was this sort of improvisation.
Yes.
Their love, their art, you know, their way that they approach life. Their life takes them to the south of the South Island of New Zealand. And so what is it about this trope of improvisation that becomes a thread throughout the entire novel?
I'm really interested in the ways that people tell stories. And by telling stories, I also mean making artworks and making pieces of art, I suppose, because all artworks have stories in them. Mo is telling a story, making her film. Lena's telling stories or trying not to tell stories, trying not to reveal stories. And Beatrix, in her paintings, is telling stories as well. So I was interested in the idea that we can get stuck in a groove telling the same story the same way, and it then that reifies it. It makes the artwork the story, when in many cases I suspect it's not. It's just a telling of the story, or a showing of the story, or a sound that we've become used to. So breaking out of that is a way of refreshing the view. It's a way of refreshing the story, but it's also a way of trying to reach the story underneath the facade, perhaps. So the story underneath the shell, the story that hasn't yet been told.
Yeah. So Beatrix and Lena live in this very remote part of New Zealand.
Yes.
And surrounding themselves with artists and artisans and beautiful voices. But Lena actually returns back to Cottesloe. Why does she come back to Australia?
Part of what was uppermost in my mind, and that I was writing out in this novel but also pondering, was what is home? How do you know where home is? And what are the circumstances that keep you away from home? And what are the circumstances that can bring you back? And that is how Lena operates through the novel. She, in a way, she doesn't have a home because she has moved around so often. But if she does have a home, then it's on the shores of Cottesloe Beach. And that reflects my circumstances as well. I grew up in Perth, in fact, Cottesloe Beach. Somehow Cottesloe Beach has become sort of iconic for me, having lived away from here for more than 20 years. So what does bring her back? For the particular time of her life that she finds herself in at the time that she comes back around about the Second World War, it's a time in her life when she has a need for a grounding in place, and Cottesloe is the only place that's going to provide that for her. But it's a very particular part of the world that she comes back to, and it's Lena really being in a little bubble of home for almost the only part of her life that she has been.
After a life playing in the ether, living in between worlds, in between places, enjoying the limbo, the space between. These are all the kinds of words that I associate with Lena and her life choices. Do you think that in the end she resolves, if she finds a point of connection?
I do think that. I hope that readers will get that from the novel. That people have asked me if I think the novel has a happy ending, and I think it does. And for me, it is that finally Lena comes to a place of connection.
And this is your debut novel. You're obviously writing ideas and characters quite close to you, and sounds like your life as well. But the one thing I took out from it was the musicality, the descriptions, the character names. At some point, there is a child who's named Grace after a Grace note. And for me, it's really the delight in indulging in the musicality of language that came through. How natural was that?
I did spend time working on the details of the musicality of it, because I love music. I love it as an amateur. I love listening to it. I love playing it, but my depth of knowledge is quite shallow. So there was a degree of making some of those details work, but I think it's probably reasonably fair to say that my writing style lends itself to that. I've always tended to work in quite a lyrical, quite a poetic style. So settling on the idea of threading the novel through with music was one that was a bit of an aha moment, I think. Everything fell into place when I knew that Lena was a musician and that music was what held this novel together.
And you have to be outed. You yourself play the theremin.
Badly. Only badly. we have two very ugly kit theremins at home, and I have tried to play them. I can get noise from them, but that's about it. I hanker after playing a lovely theremin, but I've never had the chance.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you so much.
Miyuki Okiranta there speaking with Tracy Farr. The Life and Loves of Lena Gaunt is published by Fremantle Press. That's it for Books and Arts Daily this morning. We're here every weekday at 10 a.m. and repeated at 2 a.m. You can catch us online whenever you like. Tomorrow on the show, we meet the producer behind the new film that's based on Tim Winton's The Turning. And one of this country's greatest living writers. He joins me to talk about a forgotten classic Australian novel. But next up here on RN, it's Bush Telegraph with Judy Kennedy. Judy, what's coming up?
Daniel, we're going to have a look at a really interesting research project looking into the production of antibodies from alpacas. There's about 130,000 alpacas in Australia, and not only will they be used for wool, but they could be used to produce antibodies that could fight cancer. So it's quite an interesting story around about 11:30.
Brilliant. Bush Telly with Judy Kennedy. I'm Daniel Browning. Stay with the network throughout your day. This has been Books and Arts Daily here on RN.